You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate this afternoon. After 20 years of traveling around the world and covering many of the major conflicts of the late 20th century as a foreign correspondent, Judith Matloff decided to put down roots and start a family. She impulsively bought a dilapidated brownstone in West Harlem and soon realized it was a former crack den on one of the busiest drug-dealing blocks in the city. In Homegirl, Building a Dream House on a Lawless Block, she recounts her adventures restoring a house and creating a home in a rough neighborhood. It's out in paperback by Random House, and I'm pleased that it's brought Judith Matloff to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What was your life like as a foreign correspondent, and how did you choose that life?
I chose it because I grew up in an incredibly dull part of Queens where all the houses looked the same. As a matter of fact, when I was a young child, my mother had to put up an incredibly ostentatious green awning because I used to walk into other people's houses. And I think from then on, I began to get an interest in things which were slightly more exotic. My parents were also social workers, and they, we lived in a very multi-ethnic part of Queens. So I think, those kind of things got me interested in it.
And walking into other people's houses as a small child is sort of like being a foreign correspondent.
It is.
So that may have been good training.
It was excellent training. And then I fell into journalism just like I think most of us do. It's a very random type of thing. I had graduated from Harvard, had a fellowship in Mexico to do some research. The fellowship ended. I knew a couple journalists. It looked really easy and fun what they did, so I just started doing what they did.
You went, though, from – I don't know what you saw in Mexico, but you went from Mexico to covering wars and genocide. How did you get drawn into that kind of work?
Well, again, it's all random. When I was in Mexico, it was Central America, the early 80s. So that was sort of, for my generation, what Iraq and Afghanistan is now for younger journalists.
Yes.
So I was already immersed in mayhem, and then mayhem leads to other mayhem. Then you get this reputation of somebody who does mayhem. And, you go to one spot, Angola, and you do it okay, and then they send you to Sudan, and then you survive. And they say, okay, this time now she goes to Burundi, and before you know it, that becomes your raison d'etre.
As a journalist, what did you say to yourself in your head as you walked towards where people were shooting at each other rather than running away, which is what most of us would probably do?
I usually would crouch.
Okay, so you wouldn't walk, you would crouch.
Crouch or hide behind something. But actually, it's a very good point you raised, because the first time I actually saw sniper fire going back and forth, my first impulse being totally ignorant and unversed in this sort of thing. And in those days, journalists didn't get conflict training. I ran right towards where the action was, and then I found myself in the middle of it and I had to hide behind a sapling. And then after that, my brain slowly adjusted to the fact that maybe this wasn't the right way to operate.
So what led you to, and it sounds like you loved this life, you loved writing about these things. What led you to say, I need to make a change now?
I was nearly 40. My mother was not of good health. My sister and I are very close, and my cousins, and I hadn't really seen them for 20 years. I was getting tired of taking bucket baths. I was tired of going to refugee camps and pinching myself and forgetting, which war is this again? Mm. I was tired of colleagues and sources being killed. So I thought, I want to go home. I want to go somewhere where it's really quiet and quote-unquote normal.
And that is sort of the central irony of your book, is that you chose to come home to New York City and you bought a house on a block that was anything but quote-unquote normal. Or I guess it was normal for a certain part of the population.
For the Dominican drug gangs, it was very normal. The cops, this is before 9/11, referred to our street, the street I had bought upon without doing my due diligence. They referred to the street as ground zero for narcotics trade on the entire northeast coast of America. For particular reasons, this street had through traffic to many different forms of transportation, be it planes and bridges and highways. And this street was where there was a gang of 60 guys, and they ran it. Of course, when the real estate agent showed it, we didn't know about that because they tend not to put that kind of thing in the write-up.
It's not two-bedrooms, fireplace, drug gangs.
Right, they haven't figured out, you know, fireplaces, like wood burning fireplaces.
FPLC, whatever, yeah. Yes.
Drug dealers, DD, you don't see it there.
Yeah. No. So when did you realize this block is not what I had expected it to be?
Pathetically too late. For some reason, the seller was in a gigantic rush to sell this thing, and the price was so unbelievably quick. Of course, suddenly, you know, my journalistic skills just imploded at this moment. I didn't do due diligence. I didn't do research. I didn't ask any proper questions. And my husband was still in Moscow. He was packing up. He hadn't even seen the house. And the house, you know, I told him on the cell phone, honey, you know, I just bid for this house and it's going to cost us every penny that we have of what we have now in our retirement savings. And all he wanted to know was, you know, what did the dining room table fit there? Was it big? You know, what shape was it in? What way did it face? My husband's very flexible and a visionary kind of person, unlike my impulsive self. So he said, okay, hon, buy it. Sounds really good. So and these sellers were desperate to close on it. So we closed in 2 weeks. And during that time, they had made a deal with the local police precinct to keep the local crack addicts at bay. So every time I would go to the building and look at it, there was nobody in there. But apparently, there was a very menacing, very hyper character who went by the name of Salami, because it's long and brown. So Salami was squatting in the crack house next to ours, but he also had proprietary claims on this house that I had just sunk every penny into.
I'm speaking with Judith Matloff. She is a journalist, and she is an author of a book called Homegirl, Building a Dream House on a Lawless Block. Now, I found it so interesting, and you are talking about it now. When you are a reporter, you do certain things, but in your own life, those things sometimes don't enter the picture. How do you think about that about yourself? What is it that engages that part of your brain when you're reporting but disengages it when you're making big purchases like a house?
Well, I think in this case, when I suddenly realized I had to negotiate with the drug gangs on the street and that I might have to give some money to the crack addict who kept saying that he wanted to take over my house again, that this whole notion that, for instance, that you keep a certain distance from your sources and you don't hand over money and that there is no such thing as a free lunch sort of went out the window. I mean, basically, we had to do everything we could to develop a good relationship with these people, and it went beyond the certain ethics of professional journalistic activity.
You also write very movingly about, this is jumping quite ahead in the story, but on 9/11, your house is finished, it's beautiful, you have a small baby, and you learn about what's happening downtown. And you write that your first instinct was to rush towards it, to go and cover the story. And then you realize that you have a baby, your second instinct is to take him, and your third instinct is, I think I should stay home now. What I found really powerful after that was how you write about how your work allowed you to kind of put a box around things like genocide and war, but when something was happening and you weren't responding to it as a journalist, it was much more difficult.
Absolutely. I mean, there just weren't those barriers there. You know, it was my own city. You know, my father, when I was a child, would take me to see the towers growing up. Suddenly, I'm a mother. I'm responsible for a young person, and all I could think of is, this the world I've brought him into? And also, you know, I had loved ones who were downtown, and I didn't know if I was losing them. And it's one thing when you're covering carnage and it's, oh my God, there are 30,000 people trapped in a village under siege, but it's another thing when your own family are missing for a few hours or whatever and you don't know what's happened to them. Yeah. And it was very difficult because I felt like I was not only going through what a lot of the people in the city were going through, but I also sort of went through a professional crisis at the same time where the journalistic instincts just weren't kicking in.
And you were a new mother, which I think just changes everything also.
Oh, definitely. When you're sleep deprived and somebody flies a plane into a tower, not a good combination.
So I want to move back a little bit to earlier in the story. So you get this house. And you put together a kind of motley crew of workmen who, I don't know the exact chronology, but in reading the book, it sounded like the work got done on this wreck pretty quickly. How did you put together this team of people?
It's this, whenever I say we, by the way, it means my husband. He's an extraordinary manager. He's one of the guys. He's not American. He speaks seven different languages, and he just knows how to, you know, hand a guy a beer and somehow get the most out of them. And I think we, you know, and I spoke fluent Spanish, so I was able to deal with the Latino staff. So we kind of split up our staff by language. And I think the fact that we lived abroad helped a bit because we had certain cultural references whereby you knew in this particular culture, you didn't scream at them, but you gently coerced in a certain way, or you encouraged or motivated in a certain way. I think that helped. I mean, maybe I'm misguided here. But also, it was so unpleasant being in the house at the time. You know, it's the dead of summer like now. You know, the temperatures are soaring up to 90, no air conditioning, dust everywhere. I think the workmen just wanted to get out of there as quick as they could, you know, take the money and get out of there. So I think that helped also.
You talked earlier about getting to know the dealers on your block, and especially, is it Miguel?
The
man who ran the dealers. How did you approach him first, and why? What did you think you needed to be able to live in that space?
Well, I had great advice because my sister and her Puerto Rican then boyfriend, now husband, are community organizers. They worked in Bushwick in the bad days in the 80s. So they dealt a lot with negotiations with drug gangs. And so they advised me and they said, look, you basically have to develop a working relationship with these people. Don't get hostile. They're basically businessmen. They want to make money. You're a homeowner. You just want some security. They're not going to target you. They make so much money. They're not going to pick at your pockets. But they're going to want to do their business. Just come to some sort of cordial business-like agreement whereby you tell them you're not going to get in the way of their business as long as their business doesn't get in the way of your immediate life, i.e. your property. Because you see, what was happening is their guys, there would be like 60 guys on the street. It was like NYMEX on the streets. And they had nowhere to go to the bathroom. So they would use our steps as a latrine. And, you know, the stoop is nice. We had a shady tree, so they'd sit there, they'd eat their lunch, and then there'd be no garbage can. So they'd, you know, dump the stuff there. So we set up a garbage can with Miguel, and Miguel would go and talk to the boys, and somehow we found a restaurant where they could relieve themselves or somebody's house where they could relieve themselves. And it was great when Miguel was there. I mean, you know, he basically was a businessman. You know, he was the managing director to go to just make sure that the operations were in order, or the human resources person.
Who would be able to address the problems.
Yeah.
You also then, though, got involved with a neighborhood group that was trying to eradicate the drug dealing on the block. What was that like, and was it something that people felt really might be possible?
Well, now this is really interesting because we were the first whites on the street in about 25 years. There had been huge white flights. So the block was split between very, very, very lower-income Dominicans, many of whom were undocumented and felt they had no power whatsoever to push the gangs off. And then you had fairly middle-class elderly black people. That was basically the demographics. And when we first moved on the block, you know, we'd heard a lot about, you know, gentrification and hostility in other parts of the city, and we were kind of wondering how we would be received. Well, what happened was the moment we arrived, the elderly women, who were largely West Indian, came and offered us platanos that were fried and cookies and cakes and tea. There was like this little procession that came. And then there was some wariness amongst the undocumented population. Was John, my husband, a cop? You know, what were these people doing on the street? But then we spoke Spanish, so we were able to win them over. And then it turned out both organizations had their own underground networks with the cops, the precinct, and the DA's office, but they never worked together. They probably didn't know they existed. And the meetings would take place off the street, and the people on the street basically acted like citizen spies. They took photographs, they took videotapes, they took down descriptions, they took down numbers of license plates, they got names and cell phones of people, and then they would deliver this to the law enforcement, which would then use it for very, very long-term investigations. So basically, people were cooperating in a fairly dangerous clandestine way as citizen spies.
We only have a minute left. What is your neighborhood like today?
All the crack buildings, the crack houses, except for one, that had been abandoned are no longer abandoned. We still have a couple of the old crack addicts on the street, such as Salami. We have more white people on the street. We have, we still have drug trade, but it's far more clandestine. Most of the guys like Miguel have either gone on the lam or they're in jail or they went back to the Dominican Republic. It's quieter, but it's still very vibrant street culture with a bit of the old activity there. And it's, you know, we have new shops that you can buy a baguette in our neighborhood. That's just extraordinary to us. But it hasn't fully gentrified, so still has a lot of what was so beautiful and vibrant about it before.
Well, Judith Metloff, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Judith Metloff about her book, Homegirl, which is published by Random House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.